Welcome to Comedy Wham Presents. I'm your host, Laura Smith. ComedyWham.com is your place to go for all Austin comedy. Comedy Wham Presents is how we bring you glimpses into the lives of comedians in and around Austin. Today I'm joined by comedian, author, former funniest person in Austin, and the man who ran the famed Velveeta Room for many years. With his recent return to the stage, I have been begging him to talk comedy with me for a while. With my sworn promise to burn the tape if he doesn't like it, Comedy Wham presents Mario DiGiorgio. Hi!
You read that very well.
Thank you. It is a... It's a thing.
You're where nervous for nothing.
I know, but, you know, just something about having to read in front of someone about them is kind of like, oh.
That's why I looked down.
I kind of did. I was just like, oh.
Yeah, I have to look away when stuff like that happens.
I felt like Lemon was judging me.
That's going to happen.
Full disclosure, Lemon is his adorable dog, and she is the sweetest little thing I've ever seen, so...
Just came out of heart surgery.
I know, and she's doing well. You would not know it. She's...
Yeah, they went up through an artery in her leg, so
yeah,
she was walking the next
ephemeral,
day.
Ephemeral, so, yeah. I bet.
Yep.
Full disclosure, I'm a medical coder, so I can geek out on that stuff, but...
But yeah, she's doing good.
Good! Hi, Lemon. Lemon still hasn't decided how she feels about me.
And she has, I'm nuts about her now, but my first dog was Oscar, and that's who I found him right before I found comedy, and then he kind of was with me until the end of my road career.
Oh, wow.
So I had him from age 27 to 40.
Oh, wow.
And he came on road trips with me, stayed in comedy condos and hotels, he met, like, Jimmy Pardo and...
He traveled
Maria
with you.
Bamford.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, he was, losing him was pretty profound. It was just this absence of ritual that I wasn't doing every day. And so there was a misfire in between there with another dog, but then 6 years later...
Miss Lemon.
Yeah, so she's great.
Miss Lemon. She's staring at me. This is going to be harder than reading. She's looking at you like, Dad, don't know.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'll ask you, Valerie likes to ask this question. I always enjoy it as an icebreaker. One word to describe your past.
Just one word?
Yeah, I know.
You mean comedy related or just
doesn't matter.
In general?
In general.
My past? I don't want to say the first word that comes to mind. It's probably true. The first word that came to mind was insecure.
It's fair.
Because it really has kind of shaped everything I do.
Yeah?
Yeah. So, and you know what? I'll say the word sincerity.
Okay.
Because I feel like every problem I have with everything, it could all trace it back to sincerity. I hate getting lied to. I don't think anybody does or enjoys it.
Yeah.
But everything, like the reason I don't go to strip clubs is...
It's all a lie.
Nothing to do with morality. I don't give a shit about that. It's just... It's the insincerity. I don't want to pay someone to be interested in me. It's,
right.
And I don't know if that's being woefully insecure or just... a realist, I don't know.
Yeah. So where did you grow up? You grew up in New Jersey?
New Jersey, yeah.
And did you live there your whole childhood, or?
Yeah, we moved when I was in the sixth grade.
Mm-hmm.
And that was actually a bad move. I'm really curious what would have happened to me if we stayed, because our neighborhood was, it was trashy. You know, we had the nicest house, I'll put that in quotes.
Yeah.
But it was, you know, as we grew older, all our kids that we were friends with became enemies.
Really?
It was just the dumbest thing. People envied our family because my parents had pride in their home and they took care of it. And so we were seen as rich, even though we were anything but.
Oh, man. You know,
the rich people on the trashy block.
Yeah.
And so after a while, and it's just, I'm sure it was the parents just saying, like, oh, those DiGiorgios, they think they're better than us, which was the, that's my big pet peeve from New Jersey, is that sort of, you think you're better than me attitude. I fucking hate it so much.
The sort of envy and...
It's like, if you have to ask that question, the answer is probably yes. You know, if you're that defensive about just everything in that whole city can be very defensive.
Yeah.
Needlessly so.
What's it? I mean, what part was it? What part of Jersey was it?
Oh, where my parents ended up moving to back in '83, and they're still there now. We were the only blue collar family in this white collar neighborhood, and it was kind of, you know, pretty.
Yeah.
Cowtown, and only 30 minutes away from where we used to live, but it was a new development, and you know, everyone's got 4 acres of nothing on their property, and so I hated it when I was a kid, and that move was painful because I had a circle of friends. I was outgoing,
mm-hmm.
and then my nose got big, and we moved, and it was just this 1-2 punch that just changed everything. I just went inside myself. That move changed everything.
How old were you then?
I was 6th grade. How old are you in 6th
grade? Oh gosh, yeah, like, so 11, 12, the toughest time.
Yeah, and I tried like crazy to fit in. If you ever watch Freaks and Geeks or watch that show, that could be my childhood. I was Sam.
Okay.
And then later in life, I was Nick. where was I going here? I forget where I was going here.
So you were in that awkward stage where you went from being outgoing.
Yeah, I just went from extrovert to introvert just because of those two things.
Yeah.
But again, I don't know if that would have changed the way my path was. I don't know. I can't get lost in thoughts like that because I kind of like where life ended up.
Yeah.
So.
Do you still consider yourself an introvert?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, extrovert has to be the life of the party, I think.
Yeah.
And even on stage, you know, I didn't get on stage because I want to be the center of attention. I want to get on stage to see if people laughed at shit that I wrote.
Yeah.
Because I moved here to write screenplays.
Okay.
And I met someone at Eastside Cafe, Justin Sanders, who I'm still friends with to this day.
Okay.
And he told me he did stand-up. I was like, oh, I love stand-up. Can I go watch? And then it was just a matter of, you know, you're not supposed to compare yourself to other people, but it can work to your advantage, too. It was, and I think plenty of people feel this way. It's like, oh, I think I can do that.
How old were you when you moved here to do screenplays?
24.
Okay.
25, yeah.
Well, before we get too far ahead, what are your first, like, comedy memories? Like, as childhood, or?
I mean, all my uncles are, like, dry and sarcastic, and all the women, all the aunts and stuff, they're all goofy, and, you know, so I just grew up around funny people, mm-hmm. you know, and I got lucky, I had a good family, you know, my mom and dad are great, they're both goofy, they're just, dependable, wonderful people who just, everyone's, and then my dad's two younger brothers, were the real sharp, always, like, they would say things like, would you rather walk to New York or take your lunch? And I remember that being the first time I heard something that didn't make sense. And I guess it was absurdity.
Yeah.
And I just loved it. My grandfather was a big fan of puns. And his big thing to say, he traveled with my grandmother at the time. You know, he'd be eating breakfast in Italy or something. He's like, I may be in Italy, but my eggs are floating in Greece. So I had all this sort of, it was just all around me. And I loved stand-up on TV.
Yeah.
You know? And when you listen to the same cadence over and over and over, that's the one thing I had when I started stand-up was the rhythm.
Yeah.
I knew, you know, I didn't know the names of things like tags or blah, 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 but I knew the cadence, mm-hmm. you know, and I knew, you know, the mechanics, but there were things that I just never got over, so.
Who are some of your first stand-ups that you remember watching?
I used to love Rich Hall.
Uh-huh.
Remember he made those Sniglet books?
Mm.
I had like 3 or 4 of those.
When I read about your book, I started thinking about Sniglets, and I for some reason I started thinking about Deep Thoughts and all that. I was obsessed with Sniglets.
Deep Thoughts. I had all those joke books when I was a kid. I had all those, they had all those ethnic joke books. And all the Italian ones, of course. Mm-hmm. Polish joke books. Polish ones in our family, too. And we never thought of it as anything mean-spirited. But they were the official Jewish joke book, the official mm-hmm. Italian joke book. And I had Truly Tasteless jokes. And
yeah.
So I think all that stuff was certainly a... what's that word there?
Maybe influential?
Influential, yeah, sure.
I'm going to break the wall for a moment and just say, if you have never read Sniglets, I think they're out of print now, but you could probably Google them. It's like deep thoughts. You could probably Google it and find it. And it was a dictionary.
Words that should have been in the dictionary,
but weren't. I know. And they were great.
We were just talking about this recently. Flen, F-L-E-N, was mm-hmm. the crusty stuff on the top of the ketchup bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Musquirt was the water that comes out first. Discombobulate was turning down the radio to find an address when you're in a car.
I'm trying to remember. And they had a lot of them had illustrations that were just hilarious to go with them.
One had like a record in the back that you can cut out. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a record, but it was shaped like a record. And you put it on a turntable and you would slowly spin it and read it.
I didn't have that one.
Yeah.
I think I only had like 2 or 3 volumes. I didn't even know there was one with that.
And, you know, my parents were, I don't say the oblivious, they just let me watch and listen to anything. And so I consumed, like, I remember not necessarily the news. I used to love that show. Mm-hmm. I used to love any stand-up that was on. Rosie O'Donnell used to host that VH1 special. That was a little later. But anyone who was doing stand-up.
Yeah.
And back then, the pool was so small that you would see the same 20 people.
Yeah.
It was easy to keep track.
So did you ever think about doing stand-up before your friend kind of pulled you out into it?
Never.
And you wanted to write?
No. It was, because I never, going on stage just seemed insane.
I could see that, yeah.
I still say this, I don't like people looking at me on stage. That's insecurity,
really?
I don't feel comfortable up there. I don't feel like I can just be myself. After all the years I did it, I never found, never found like I was able to just relax.
Yeah.
Every so often I'd have those magical shows, but for the most part I was just, I felt like I did a great impression of a comedian.
See, I was going to say, you must have something, because there must be something that you're doing, because to me, when I saw you, it's been probably a month or two ago, you looked so relaxed. To me, it looked effortless, and I know that seems crazy, probably.
Yeah, no, inside, I tried a brand new thing about being insecure, and I was just shaking inside, because it, the first time I ever said it, I don't know why I did that, brought a new bit to a show. I would chastise a comedian for doing that.
But it didn't come through. That's the funny part. Like, that never translated to me. You seemed so at ease and at home on that stage that it didn't register that you would have ever left.
No, it's all in my head. Or I get in my head.
Yeah, I think that's a common theme amongst comedians, especially the introverted ones.
And I know when comics say, I feel like a fraud, which I always feel like a fraud. I mean, I really feel like a fucking fraud. Mm-hmm. I really feel like when really amazing comics come through, just these powerful people. And even Todd Barry is powerful in his way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a... necessarily mean like sound and boisterous and sound and fury comics. I just I see them and I see what I do and I'm like, I'm not doing anything close to what they're doing.
Really?
Yeah. So, when people say, I had a bad set and they really had a good set, it's like, I know when I had a good set and I know when I have a bad set. And I feel like I'm plenty aware of what I do. I don't know, we're all hard on ourselves and blah, blah, blah. But I really, I don't know. I feel like I've just...
So with that level of insecurity and being that much of an introvert, there has to be something that outweighs it to pull you back up. What is it?
Yeah, it was the validation from jokes.
Yeah.
That's it. It wasn't, I didn't want them to like me. It wasn't look at me, it was listen to me.
Right.
It was listen to this joke.
Right.
And I was never an agenda comic. It's not listen to this opinion.
Yeah.
It's like, hey, here's something funny I wrote. What do you think? And that's the same way with all of the t-shirts and shit that I do. It's like, I don't know, that was, maybe that's a little kid in me. I would always draw and then show people, but that validation was the only reason I would keep going on stage.
Yeah.
What
was your first open mic like?
It's great.
Really?
Yeah, it was great. I shot out like a cannon.
Okay.
And then plateaued.
Did you feel confident about it at the time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I felt like there was something I was good at and something I enjoyed. But I've said this plenty of times, I was better when I was naive, you know? When I didn't have too much to compare myself to. I went to New York way too early. I remember Colleen and Duncan set me up on this Montreal showcase. I was a year and a half into comedy.
Oh, wow.
And I was on the stage with Todd Barry and Pete Coriolli. I played this, you know, it was the Gotham Comedy Club.
Mm-hmm.
And then I closed with this fucking beat poem I did about hippie chicks with hairy legs. I was just terrible. And I killed in Austin.
I was going to say, but how did...
Killed here.
Okay.
But I was... And also, when I get in my head, I can't deliver anything.
Right.
No, my delivery just gets shot to hell if I'm feeling insecure. So, even a decent joke, I can fuck up with a sheepish delivery.
Yeah.
So, but it was not just my delivery that night. It was like hearing everything else and knowing that I'm next and last and don't belong here. So that was my first time on stage in New York. And then I got passed at the comic strip, which I didn't know what it meant.
Right.
I met the old owner, Lucian Hold.
Okay.
Who by that time he was losing fingers because of his illness.
Oh,
and so I didn't get to know him too well. But, you know, he's one of those comic strip legends. He's
mm-hmm.
he's one of those guys, the guy who gives people breaks or... Anyway, I did my showcase for him and he said, well, we got a lot of white guys. And again, this was 20-some years ago. It's always been a problem.
Right.
But yeah, I like the similes that you're doing. He was telling me it's like I was kind of like Dennis Miller-esque
mm-hmm.
in certain parts, my act. And so he passed me and he's like, yeah, just, you know, come back. And I didn't know. I didn't know that I was there to audition.
Right.
I just thought I was there and the manager was just going to talk to me who booked the club. And then 6 months later, I was talking to a comic who wanted to get into that club. I was like, oh, yeah, I got passed or something there. He's like, what? And I didn't show up for 6 months because I didn't know what
it
meant.
You didn't know what it meant.
No. And so then I started showing up, but it was, you know, 11 o'clock spots, 11:30. You get $10, but
right.
got bumped by Dave Chappelle one night who was doing
oh, wow.
a new 20. And by the time I got on, there were literally two people left.
Hmm.
So, yeah, it was discouraging living up there.
Yeah.
And I moved up there way too early. Didn't really have a big circle of friends yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't have that support system. I was completely underwhelmed with so many comics in New York. You know, just comedy. New York has the best comics, but it has the fucking worst, too.
Yeah.
And tons of them.
And you said you were like, what, a year and a half, 2 years in when you went?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah.
And I was thrown in. I was playing Luna Lounge, I think because I had tiny glasses at the time. I played there with like Sarah Silverman and Janine Garofalo. And I mean, I was clever. I didn't get dirty until I started working the road. So I guess that I was standing out there as well. I wasn't swearing. I was using lots of references. I was more of a writer than a performer, but the writing was enough to carry me through.
Yeah.
Because I didn't get in my head yet, because I was just writing what I thought was funny, which is what you should do. I started writing what I thought they would like.
Yeah.
After a while. I forget how this started, but we talked about New York.
Yeah, it's your story arc. So let's, okay. When you became a road comic, had you come back to Austin already?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I would come back here once a year. Actually, Rich Miller offered to put me on the road as a middle.
Okay.
Before I left. And again, a year and a half in. And he wanted me to do 30 minutes. And I said, no, I don't have it. You know, I remember he put me on the radio for the first time. And this, I can explain why Dudley and Bob have a distaste for me. And it's all because of being thrown on there way before I was ready.
Yeah.
And I was just intimidated as fuck. I was there in front of these DJs. And I was a college DJ for a while. And,
yeah. And they were a mess back in DJs, that day, you know? Too.
Yeah, and this is 20 years ago.
Yeah, that was probably right around Dale's Coke days.
Okay. And I was just quiet. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know. I'm not a big personality, and I just won this contest. I had no business winning.
Right.
And they would have me on subsequently, and I remember once when I did the... That book became the bit, the Cynic's Guide bit. Mm-hmm. When I first, it was self-published first before it got published. And when it was self-published, I took it up to Indianapolis when I was on the road for the first time ever. And that's where Bob and Tom Radio is.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea who Bob and Tom was.
Right.
Didn't know they were nationwide. They were in New Jersey, so I never heard them.
Right.
But they were huge. And at the time, the booker of the club didn't like the headliner and said, "Hey, Mario, are you good on the radio? Do you want to go?" And I was like, "Well, I got this new book. This is something." And it was awesome. You know, Bob and Tom loved that book. That first time couldn't have gone better. Bob had a long-haired dachshund also. And so we bonded there. And Tom hated the books that I was lampooning. And I ended up selling like almost $5,000 worth of merch
over That's incredible.
The next 4 months. You asked me to go on the road.
Well, do you think that, kind of like you said, the naive, you weren't able to get in your head yet.
Yeah.
Do you think that whole, like, not knowing they were national, not knowing things helped you kind of stay confident?
Sorry, the point of that story was I did great, you know, and I would actually do great on all the radio stations I would go on, and I would always tank on Dudley and Bob,
mm-hmm.
but I was so excited because I had this book, and I had tanked maybe twice prior. And Dudley would call attention to it. It's like, "Oh, you don't talk much, blah, blah, blah." And I'm just mealy mouth and insecure.
Mm-hmm.
And so I got this book, and I remember once I brought him coffee, like a fucking idiot. You know? It's like, my mom she's the consummate host, so I just got that from her.
I
have dinner parties, and I like, you know, doing stuff for people. So I thought it would be nice to show up with a tray of 4 Starbucks. And
it is.
I ended up just sitting there. No one gave a shit. And so on top of that, and then maybe that was a different visit, but I had the book and I was so excited because it went over gangbusters on mm-hmm. Bob and Tom. And I just thought it was a shoe, and I thought, "Oh, I can finally just break this stupid fucking spell I have here." And the first one he opened up was a diss on Andy Griffith.
Oh God.
And he just put it right down. And I was like, "You gotta be shitting me. You read one and you put it down," and that was it. I didn't know what to do. And this was what, and again, I think this was the same visit, maybe not. But he finally said, "Boy, you don't talk much when you're here." And I was like, "Do you know why?"
Oh, I'm so excited.
And by this time, I was just fucking, I was mad at myself because I have this thing where when I get intimidated, I get obsequious and I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't help it sometimes. It just happens. I clam up. But this time I was just pissed. I'm just pissed. And so I was like, "Do you know why I don't say anything here? I feel like I'm on a date with a girl who's not interested in me. You don't ask me questions. You don't engage. You don't do anything every other radio station in this country does. It's like, this is the only station I tank on. Why is that? What?" And it turns out that they fired Bearden for the same complaint.
Yeah.
And then they realized, "Oh, wait, we're kind of wet for his demographic, so let's bring him in." And thank fucking God they did that.
Right. Yes, all the warriors are very happy about that.
So, but that was it. And I just hate it because, you know, they told Rich Miller after that episode that, and I don't blame them at all, that, hey, we like him on stage, but in the, they called me a funeral dirge. And they're right. I was terrible. But, you know, there's never an explanation. There's never a, like, oh, maybe it was us. Maybe, you know, we should listen to all the comics who hate doing that show, which is something else. You go on radio everywhere else, you're there for 20 minutes or 30, and you're out of there.
Right.
These knuckleheads want you there for
they
three
want you
hours.
To be a part of the show.
Yeah, part of it, but not
yeah.
too much.
Yeah. So you, at what point did you move back and stay in Austin? So you moved back and made it your home base.
I was gone for 3 years.
And then went on the road for three years.
Yeah, I would come back here once a year and perform.
Okay.
30th birthday with Mitch Hedberg. That was a fantastic week.
Okay.
And every year I'd come back, I'm like, why did I leave?
Right.
So I came back in 2003, and oh God, I was so happy. I remember I got a car again. And I finished errands in 2 hours and thought that would have taken me an entire week in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I was spending 30 hours a week just getting places in New York.
Yeah.
And that's impractical.
Did you ever even have the itch to go to the other coast?
No, but I think that's what I should have done.
Really?
Yeah.
I hear comedians describe them so differently. But it seems very definitive who loves what and why and everything. And
well, New York, I thought, would be the safer choice because I was from New Jersey.
Mm-hmm. You know?
And I've been living away from my family since I was 19.
Right.
So, seemed like a no-brainer. And you always heard that, oh, comics play in New York, you know. And I will say the Comedy Cellar is the best club in this country.
Right.
Some of the best shows there.
Yeah. And you're able to get more stage time because you're not stuck in traffic for a million hours in New York versus LA, as far as you could do multiple shows a night because you're not stuck in a car trying to get to your next gig.
I have no experience. I finally went through LA for five days.
Uh-huh.
And it was not as scary as I thought it was. I don't know why. It was just intimidating in my, like, more so than New York.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, New York was more familiar, so I think that's why I went there.
That makes sense. So after the 3 years on the road, you come back.
No. After 3 years in New York.
Oh, okay.
I come back.
You come back here, and then you go on the road. How long are you on the road?
I was on the road for 9 years, about 25 to 30 weeks per year.
That's a lot.
Yeah. Now, towards the end, it was ebbing because I was crossing clubs off my list.
Okay.
And then it took me forever to get into this guy, Dave Stroop. He books like 14 Funny Bones and Improvs, and those are the ones to work because they pay well.
Right.
And you get to work with awesome headliners. And he passed me the first time. Didn't work me until 4 years later.
Really?
And I'm so glad that I didn't get impatient.
Okay.
So I did one more showcase for him, and I was on the... I did really well, and then on the spot, he gave me 6 weeks. And so then I was able to work his clubs for the next couple of years.
Oh, wow.
So that helped a lot. That one guy unlocked a lot of doors. And then Daniel Tosh got me into a couple of rooms. Jimmy Pardo would get me into a room or two. And that was just, we just got thrown together at one point.
Yeah.
And we got along. Because then when you're stranded in South Dakota, like Jimmy Pardo and I, you know, maybe he didn't want to have lunch with the middle.
Yeah.
But we did, and we had fun.
I think that might be one of the best people to be stranded with.
My favorite thing about comedy was, and again, I felt like a tourist, was meeting some of my childhood heroes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I worked with Dana Gould and Jake Johansson and just all these guys I adored.
Yeah.
And... you know, I was smoking out in my car with Andy Kindler for a week. I mean, just all those memories are awesome because I've always surrounded myself with funny, smart people. And my God, you know, comedians are the, you know, they're just, they get everything.
Yeah.
So that's the one thing I found when I found comedy, is I found, like, I didn't have to apologize to anybody for anything. Everyone got everything. Everyone was hip to everything.
Yeah.
That's changing, but...
Well, we didn't even talk too much about the book. How long did it take you to write that? How long did you work on that?
I spent about 3 days in Chicago.
Really?
It was a bit that, you know, I wrote maybe 20 of them just to get the bit out.
Okay.
Because my parents or my mom had this book. It was on Joy. It was mm-hmm. a little itty-bitty hardcover book.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just flipping through it, and I just started imagining all these tags for every one. And so I started writing, you know, I introduced the bit as even that. Like, my mom has one of these ridiculous life-slip instruction books and...
Mm-hmm.
And blah, blah, blah. And I remember the first time I took it on stage, I was in Fort Wayne, Indiana. And I was eating shit for 15 minutes. And it was a full house. They did not like me. And then I was like, well, fuck it. And I pulled this list out, and it was just the polar opposite.
Really?
I went from being hated to applause. It was insane. You know, it was a brand new bit. I was confident because I knew it was funny.
Yeah.
It had worked in other cities, too. And it was just, you know, that's when I knew I had something special. So then I was in Chicago visiting a friend. I wasn't performing. And I just went to a bookstore and just pulled all these karma books off the shelf
mm-hmm.
and just sat there with a notebook and just wrote 300 of them over 3 days.
Really?
And then I came back here and culled down the best ones, made the first self-published book, and then the second one, and then... they sold in a store here,
uh-huh.
and that guy took them to the Comic-Con in San Diego, and that's where Last Gasp saw them and said, oh, we want to publish these.
Oh, my God.
So it's been its fourth pressing already.
Yeah.
I'm really embarrassed of most of it now.
Really?
I told them if we do a fifth pressing, I'd like to remove some shit.
Okay. Would you add some stuff?
Maybe. Let's see.
Does it, I mean... You say you want to remove some stuff, but do you think that it still speaks to you? Because from reading some of the ones that I did see and seeing some of the ones that are online, does it still line up, though, with your comedy sensibility? Or
yeah, no, it's just some that I don't think are funny enough.
Okay.
Or some that I was like, oh, yeah, I guess if people haven't read the original book, this one wouldn't make sense.
Gotcha.
You know? So there's a few that I would take out, and there's a few that I would take out because I don't want to get people getting in a tizzy over something they misunderstood. I can't even point to anyone in particular, but I just know.
But you can just imagine there's something in there.
I mean, the whole book is, the whole point of it is it's funny because it's wrong.
Right.
It's hard to get that across to people. But again, there's never any ill will behind my comedy, ever.
Right. I can see that. So, when did you finally plant roots here?
In 2003.
Okay.
And then, I started going on the road within a year, and then stopped touring in 2012.
Okay. And then, when you stopped touring, you were still working shows in Austin, though?
Yeah, I made a choice to sell my car so I can stop saying yes to road gigs I didn't want anymore.
Okay.
And I guess it's a good position to be in, to say no. But I didn't want to travel to places I didn't like going to not come back with much money.
Yeah.
And it just, yeah, after a while it gets to you. It was fun for the first several years especially. But I performed in town. I didn't consider quitting yet. I just wanted to quit the road.
Gotcha.
And so I would still do Moon Tower.
It's a hard life to keep.
Yeah, and I thought I had done enough of it.
Right.
It's like, that was 9 years. That's enough.
So that's a whole lifetime.
So then I stopped. Then the Velveeta came up.
That's what I was going to say. So the t-shirt business, did that start before the Valve or?
Oh, yeah. That started when I moved back in 2004.
Okay.
Because Parts and Labor just opened on Congress.
Gotcha.
And, boy, talk about stuff you're embarrassed of. I can't believe that they accepted. They weren't dirty or anything. They were just,
right.
It's just so easy and lazy. But they sold for some reason. And I'm an idiot for not keeping them well stocked. Mm-hmm. Because if I was on the road all that time, I could have had those shirts making my passive income for me. But gotcha. I was afraid to take that first big chunk of money, which was so stupid in hindsight. I could have been making plenty of more money. Especially right. the last several years when I really beefed up my design game. Uh-huh. And I had all these like hits for a while. I was still on the road and I had all these great designs. And I was an idiot about not talking.
So the majority of them did have like humor behind them, though.
They were all pretty much humor based with design in mind.
Okay. Which is Austin's jam.
Yeah, I had plenty of misses. Yeah. You know? It's just, they're just like jokes. Sometimes you get excited about something that everyone hates, mm-hmm. and you throw something together that everyone loves.
Right.
And you ride your old material for way too long. I mean, I've been making money off one design for the past 7 years.
Really?
Not just that one.
Right.
But I mean, that's how, that's why this whole mock band t-shirt I'm doing, mm-hmm. this is the most work I've done, most design work I've done in like 10 years.
Wow.
And I've done it in a month just because I just got so stagnant. It's the same with comedy. I got tired of my material. I didn't want to write anything new. I thought I was tapped out. I thought I was unfunny. And the same with t-shirts. I feel like, you know, everyone's a better designer than me and blah, blah, blah.
You get in your head.
Oh, sure.
So when was the first time you saw, so you started this shirt company. When was the first time that you were out and you just randomly saw a stranger wearing your stuff?
I remember the one time I was at the Fleet Foxes concert in ACL, mm-hmm. and he was just wearing the one that I still sell today. It's at the Don't Walk sign, but it's like a, it's called Cowped, the cow pedestrian. It's just it's the walk guy uh-huh. from the Don't Walk sign, or right. the walk sign. He just has a cowboy hat and a gun. And
oh yeah, I know that shirt.
It's just real simple.
Yeah. That's you.
That was cool to see that. Yeah.
Okay. So.
And that's exciting. That's validation. That's why yeah. comedy wasn't
that hard. It's someone wearing your joke.
Yeah.
Around as a statement.
Yeah. If people want to spend $20 on something that you made.
Yeah.
It's like, oh yeah, that's like a hearty laugh.
So, then how did the Valve come into play?
Dana was ready to go. And I remember I sat down with Summer Brow. Mm-hmm. Summer and JR used to run it for about a year.
Okay.
Before Dana took over. And Summer would run the bar and do all the posters. And she was like the front of the house. And JR would book it and bartend when he had to. And
I didn't realize he had run it for a while.
Yeah, he was doing most of the back end stuff. Summer was the one you saw and dealt with.
Okay.
So I was done touring. And I said, hey, Summer, we want to get some lunch to talk about taking over the Valve? Because good God, that place needs help. And so she ended up, she was interested, but then, you know, I can't do it. Whatever happened, I don't know the yeah. reason. Maybe it was going to demand more of her time than she anticipated. So I talked to Dana, and I talked to Austin first, and he said Dana might be on his way out. Mm-hmm. And so Dana and I talked, and that's it. That job was so much fun. It
yeah.
was everything I learned everywhere, like service industry, comedy, t-shirts, just everything in one job. I got to play my personal playlist all the time. That was huge. I got to decorate it and revamp it and make new signs. It was
yeah, you gave it a shot yeah. in the arm, didn't you? I read, I forget where what I was reading, that it went through a whole new redesign under you.
There's still stuff inside that I would love to get rid of, but I want to push my luck.
Right.
Because they were, the owners were really cool about all the work that I did want to get done. Like they, the walls were so busy, and the stage was very distracting, like lots of colors and backgrounds. I just wanted to make it elegant, but I just got tired of my big thing was wacky. I'm like, no more wacky.
Right.
Comedy clubs are not wacky. Comedy clubs aren't wacky anymore.
It's the 80s.
Yeah. And so that's why when you go into the Valve now, it's subtle.
It's beautiful, quite frankly.
Well, you also go when the lights are down.
Well, I've seen the come up once or twice. But
there's this purple and green shit up on the high ceilings that they're curtains, and then they had these plants in between, the jungle scene in between the curtains, and it was just, oh, what an eyesore. And I asked him if he'd paint over it, and so he left the purple curtains and then used this day-glow green to cover the plants, and it looks worse. Now it looks like Barney's toes. If you look, it looks like a close-up of Barney the dinosaur's toes and, like, three nails.
I'm going to have to look.
Next time you look, yeah. You see the three arches are fluorescent green, and the rest, the purple curtain, look like his...
But you stared at this for years, so...
Yeah, I should have taken that. It bothered me so much, but I did nothing about it. Because the lights were down, it covered.
Right.
But all that wood you see, all that reclaimed wood that they put up, that's all from their farmhouse.
Nice.
Not their actual house. They had,
right. Well, so you were there for 4 years.
Yeah.
Do you remember the first show under you?
No.
No?
No, I don't.
You were probably too nervous that night to bother worrying about...
Yeah, there was so much minutiae.
Right.
And Pat Bean can attest to that. There's just so much because... And a lot of it's because it's just outdated systems. And you have to kind of unlearn the sophisticated ways you may have learned at other restaurants.
You have to Fonzie some things.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, you know, I made a list of things I won't miss about the place when I left.
Really?
And one of it was, I'm just tired of dealing with the building.
Okay.
Yeah.
Was this your pros and cons to convince yourself it was time?
It didn't take too much.
Okay.
You know, in 4 years, I feel like school set that up for me. 4 year cycles.
That makes sense. That makes sense.
I could have stayed maybe another year, but 6th Street really started to fuck with my anxieties. I hated the booking. I hate saying no to people.
Uh-huh.
It's the worst because I know what rejection feels like. And
yeah.
To be the person who makes that person feel that way.
Mm-hmm.
Ugh.
Yeah, I could see that. It's weird that those things in comedy can be character building, though. After talking to comedians for so long, hearing those kinds of things, like sometimes the rejections are the things that seem to give them the boost that you're either going to, you're in it or you're not, kind of thing.
It was something I hated doing, but I still did it.
Right.
And
because if you had somebody who was eating shit on stage every night, that's going to reflect on who booked them.
And I would never, I didn't do favors for friends.
Right. You
know, I didn't want to be one of those bookers. It's like, when I took that job, I wanted to get everything right that comedy clubs get wrong.
Right.
And the biggest thing being the guy in charge.
Right.
Some guys are like ex-comics who still want to be all about them and they still get on stage. There's a guy in Florida who does that. It's like he gets up, does all his email jokes and it's just dreadful.
Oh, God.
I want the comics to feel, I wanted the comics to have a home.
Yeah.
Where they didn't feel uncomfortable, but they also knew that they couldn't bring their bullshit on the weekends. So I was picky.
Yeah.
If there was ever a notion if I was unfair, the one guy I mentioned before, Justin Sanders, who I credit with giving me my career, I couldn't headline him. It's like, Justin, I love you, but I can't headline you.
Yeah.
And it was just based on an act. And so I can't. It was this thing where it's like I hated saying no, but I had to say no.
Right.
If you're not ready for the weekend, or if you're not ready for whatever,
right.
It doesn't help you. You know, when people blow smoke up your ass, and I just read somebody's screenplay, and I gave him all this really poignant information or poignant feedback.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I really appreciate you just shooting straight because so many people just. I'm like, I know. They don't want to tell you what's wrong because they don't want to hurt your feelings.
Right.
But if there's something glaring that needs attention, it's like telling someone or not telling someone they have spinach in their teeth.
Right.
You're an asshole if you don't tell somebody.
It's called constructive criticism for a reason.
So and it's some stuff like, you know, I was told, hey, you shouldn't look at the ground. There's stuff like that.
Right.
But also, and I stopped doing this, I stopped giving unsolicited advice to comics.
Yeah.
Because And I didn't do it too much. It didn't take too long for me to figure out, like, oh, yeah, you know what? If they come up and ask me, that's one thing. But, you know, I would say, hey, that joke worked better last time when you said this word.
Mm-hmm.
And like, oh, okay. And then they wouldn't take my advice. I'm like, all right, well, I see what's going on. I'm either the old guy who doesn't know shit, or I'm who I used to be, which is, I'll listen to your advice, but, you know, I'm going to pick and choose. But yeah. I did take good advice, though. I did take, if people wrote a tag for me, I would take it. Because that's just, you'll give someone else a good tag. You know, yeah. There should be a camaraderie.
Yeah.
Because I think comedy is such a special thing that, I don't know, everyone should get along.
I agree. What was your favorite moment? Do you have a favorite moment? Or you can give me a few from time at the Valve.
Oh, at the Valve? You know what really sucks is about a year in, I met someone. And long story short, she would end up being... I've never been hurt by any person, not just a woman, but it fucked me for the next 3 years.
Oh, wow.
And I felt like... You know, I still look back at that time. I'm like, God damn it. I was a sad bastard my last 3 years there.
Oh,
and that could have been so much fun.
Right.
But I didn't enjoy festivals.
Yeah.
South by could suck a dick. I hate everything about it. Moon Tower was fun.
Yeah.
That was a nice tight festival. And the streets weren't insane because it was just Moon Tower. It wasn't South by. So it was tolerable.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I don't know. Moments, I liked kind of all of it. I liked producing new shows.
Mm-hmm.
I started feeling the same way I felt when I performed. Like my mood was only as good as the last show.
Okay.
And I still felt a responsibility to put on good shows for people. And we had, and sometimes I'd get pissed if there was an awesome comic and there was, you know, an audience that either didn't appreciate them or they were all across the street doing some other shit that was popular that day. Like, comedy is never the thing to do instead of.
Yeah.
You know, it's something always comes up and blocks comedy.
Well, and the Late Show at the Valve had that challenge of Esther's Follies letting out and then the sea.
And that was, there's a lot of things I made. I made rules. Like, one thing was I moved all the times up so we wouldn't get that that big rush of people until later when the place was filled. And by that time, there were hardly any seats. So it's like, well, sorry.
Smart.
Can't come in.
Smart.
They were obtrusive. And they were drunk already. And they just sat through an hour and a half of this huge show.
Right.
It's like, don't come over. It's not a good ending.
Right. It's a totally different...
Yeah.
Totally different vibe, totally different scene, and you're walking into, and... Yeah. So I did see that as one of your challenges.
Open mic was atrocious before I got to it.
Yeah.
But again, not my idea. It was an idea I saw in Minneapolis. The way they ran the open mic was beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was efficient. The host stayed in the back of the room. That wastes so much time. They're up and down, up and down, up and down. So we got rid of the hosts and we capped it down from 38 comics to, I was doing 22, 19 sometimes.
Yeah.
Because I wanted it to be a show. Because when I took over, there were, you know, 15, 20 mics in town or stages. And, you know, ages ago when I was doing it, there was the Valve and Cap City.
Right.
But, so one of these had to be like a really good open mic.
Yeah.
Well run. And...
Did you feel a big competitiveness with Cap City?
No.
I didn't think so.
No, I made a point to tell Chandy and Margie and Colleen, I'm like, we're not in competition. I don't ever want you to think. If I ever do anything that you think rubs you wrong, please tell me.
Yeah.
It's counterproductive to comedy. I hate those cities that are like, oh, you can't work Morty's if you work Crackers.
Right.
And it's like, that's... Headliners back-to-back, sure.
Right.
But openers and features, no one gives a shit.
I told Margie before, and I think that most people in this town agree, that I think the camaraderie between both clubs sets a tone for the entire scene.
Absolutely.
It's such a beautiful, supportive scene.
Why would you not want your locals to have as much quality stage time as possible? It behooves everybody.
Right.
And so, yeah, when there's clubs that won't let the opener play the club a half hour away, what the fuck is wrong with you?
And I've seen you at Cap City. I've seen Margie at the Valve. You know, it's like... Yeah.
It should be friendly.
A beautiful scene, and I just...
And it's not... The audiences are so different.
Right.
Cap City people are not downtown people.
Right. It's, you know, there's some of us that cross over, but yes, by and large...
Yeah, on such a regular basis that it's like, hey, I saw that comedian at Cap City 6 months ago. You know, that shit doesn't happen. They always had it in their head that, like, oh my God, you know, everyone's going from comedy club to comedy club week after week, and they don't want to see that. It's like, no, when you go, you're done for a while. You don't go back for 6 months usually.
Right. Unless you're crazy.
Unless you're a fan of comedy.
Unless you're crazy like us.
That was, you know, that's something else that I don't understand about today's young comics.
Uh-huh.
One of my favorite things about becoming a comic, an open micer, was seeing any show at Cap City for free. Are you shitting me?
Right.
It was awesome. Even I would go if there was someone I knew I wouldn't like or think I wouldn't like a Rodney Carrington, and be blown away by his professionalism. And that was a lesson like, okay, you know, I don't have to like these guys, but I can respect, like, music. I'm not into Bob Dylan, or I can respect the shit out of them, but it's not my cup of tea.
Who's someone that you would jump out of your chair to see no matter what? Is there someone still playing today that you would...
Someone I would always leave the house for.
Yeah.
Chad Daniels.
Okay.
He is... I hope he has, like, a huge heyday one day.
Yeah.
I mean, he does fine.
Right.
Like, but kind of like Brian Regan in that sense, where he's not on anyone's household list, but amazing. So I hope Chad goes that route, if anything.
Where do you've seen, I mean, you've been in the industry now for, is it fair to say, 20?
Started in 98, in late 98.
So we're at about 21 years now. You won FBIA pretty fast out.
Yeah.
99, right?
Yeah, 8 months after.
And then,
again, right time, right place, right judges.
Yeah. How do you feel about, like, there's trends in comedy, there's, you know, the culture reflects it so much, too. How do you feel about where comedy's at right now?
That question gets asked a lot these days, right? Sorry. Mute that. Where do I think comedy's at right now? I think we need another Lenny Bruce.
Yeah.
Pretty soon. Because things are getting ridiculous. And
something
the one thing about comics
up.
Is comics, well, this was before the internet, but I feel like comics tell the truth.
Mm-hmm.
I think everyone's now so afraid of getting caught saying anything. Which again sounds like an excuse to say something terrible, but I mean people overreacting to a word or something.
Right. No, absolutely.
Back in the day, if you said Jesus on stage, and if someone would just, well, what? That word Jesus? Now I'm offended. You know, just that kind of non-offense.
Right.
You
feel like we're back in a cycle.
We're getting there again. But then again, you go to comedy clubs and you hear, you know, you can still go to a Midwestern comedy club and listen to a quote-unquote road comic just get filthy and inappropriate and they're safe. But those comics, maybe they can't work these clubs over here because they are... but I'm getting off track here. I'm afraid we're not going to see any giants anymore.
Yeah.
And I feel that way about music, too.
Do you feel like that with... With the accessibility of social media and YouTube and all those things, that maybe we don't see giants because everything's so diluted by accessibility?
Well,
is that maybe?
Also, giants are guys who, guys colloquially, people, comics, who just stay in the business forever.
Yeah.
And they are comics for life. And like, I don't know if we're gonna see another Chris Rock, Dave Chappelle, Bill Burr. I feel like, I don't know.
Do you feel like maybe that other industries take them in and they become actors?
Well, I don't know anyone in Austin who wants to go on the road, for example.
Right.
I don't know anyone who wants to have comedy album after comedy album.
True.
And I mean, I love when I turn on Netflix and I see, oh, Tom Segura got a third special out. Mm-hmm. Or John Mulaney, I would say, is a giant right now. He's well on his way if he's not already. I mean, his last special was crazy. And I think there's a deep effort, I heard that expression recently and I'm using it a lot. There's a deep effort that all those giants have mm-hmm. that I think is becoming more and more evasive. Because if you told someone who's starting out in comedy, it's going to take you 10 years to find your voice, how many people would stay for 10 years? They all want to be the exception.
Right.
That goes beyond comedy, but everyone wants to be like Andrew Dismukes, who 20-something, a couple of years in, now he's on SNL. It's like, that is such a rare story.
Right.
But everyone wants to be that. Everyone right. thinks, I can move out to L.A. Any comic, young comic who thinks their shit is crushed fruit and thinks they should have something within a year and a half or 2 years or even 5 years is being ridiculous.
Yeah.
And I even mean that like to benefit them. It's like, you don't want to pull a Dat Fan, you know? Like I hated getting that. Winning that contest was awesome, I guess, but there was pressure put on me. And it was fine for a while, but you know, what if you're further along and you pop early?
Yeah.
That could be detrimental to your career. And I think when you're young and excited, even though being naive may carry you through some shit, it doesn't mean you'll have a solid 45 minutes anytime soon.
Right.
That makes sense?
Yeah.
But, so I don't know if anyone is willing to have an hour's worth of material and then another hour and another hour. I don't know anybody around here who wants to do that.
I hear comedians talk all the time about how, like, there's that, as soon as they record their album or their special, there's that immediate sinking feeling because now everything that they've been working this hard on, that baby has been born, and they have to start immediately over.
And there's lots of people who won't. They'll just keep doing the same shit over and over.
Right.
And that's when you start losing work.
Right.
But that depresses me about like designers on Instagram. Mm-hmm. I follow a lot of designers, and well, two things are sad about it. Once this beautiful thing that this person worked on for hours, maybe even a week or longer, even if I like it, that's all it gets.
Yeah.
5-10 seconds of my time, this thing that took you so long.
Right.
And then also the people who don't even give a shit about it. And so that's like starting over on a, every time you make this beautiful piece of whatever and release it to the world to get your validation. It's like, well, now I gotta spend another week. So, but yeah, comics profession, yeah, it's like it takes a little longer to get an hour's worth of material written. You know, I thought bands are like that too. There's always that
new album, and then boom,
they
get to tour on it for a little while,
and then they have to go back to the studio. And I get impatient sometimes. It's like, Jesus, Fleet Foxes, it's been 4 fucking years.
So, okay, you you decided to leave the Velf, and you're getting back on stage now.
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, I really don't. After that last time you saw me, I just came home and I was like, I don't want to talk about that anymore.
Really?
But I don't know what I want to talk about.
Okay.
And if I can't just get up there. That's why I'm not like one of those old school guys I'm telling you about who run clubs now.
Right.
To get on stage. I never have an itch to get on stage. I have never been dying to get on stage. Except when I was starting out because I couldn't wait to try new shit.
Right.
But nowadays, yeah, that set didn't feel great. And, I don't know. I question the point of me doing it anymore. Okay. Besides being social. That is huge.
Right.
But I will say, I can't really give an answer now because I'm so consumed with this project I'm working on.
Yeah.
And it's for the first time in years, I'm excited about something I'm working on.
And this is the shirts?
Yeah, these are the concert shirts for bands that never existed.
I love it.
And I made I already have 30...
It's in the vein of Sniglet as far as I'm concerned. It's that...
Again, this is everything I love. It's music, it's comedy, it's design... It's puns, it's I can be derivative because I'm kind of doing parody of genres, not really a parody of a group. And I'm having a blast, you know. I did 24 already, and there's series one has 30, and that goes back to me collecting wacky package or Garbage Pail Kids when I was a kid, and baseball cards that had the checklist.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about it because I'm proud of what I've done, which is so rare that I'm proud of anything I do.
Right.
But I do feel like this is one of those things where the whole is going to be more impressive than one or two of them.
Gotcha.
Like when you step back and see all 30 of them, it's like, oh, this is a cool...
This is a collection.
This is a cool concept.
Okay.
So when I get past this, I wanted to front load my 2019 because 2018 was nothing but sloth.
Okay.
And post-Velveeta depression. So I want to front load this year, so I'm getting all 30 done right now, and then spend the rest of the year shopping them. So after that, maybe, I'll be in the mood to try comedy again, but I also don't want to be one of those guys who clogs up stages when I'm not really doing this anymore. So, but I can't say no just yet because I may change my mind in 2 months.
Yeah.
And we'll see.
Is there something nice about being at this point, and this, correct me if I'm wrong, this is what I'm hearing, you're at the point where you've done so many different things that you have the ability to kind of sit back and choose like what you really, really want to do.
It sounds more like a luxury than it is.
Okay.
But like this past year has been miserable.
Okay.
Because it was kind of walking away from comedy after 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, everything. From an open micer to a touring comic to running a club and just gone. All of it just out of my life. And it felt weird. Because that was a huge part. And 20 years of your life and all of a sudden,
right,
it's over.
Do you think maybe that's why you got back up on stage for a minute?
No. Well, I think... I got back on because they asked me and I felt like, if you're asking me, that's better than asking. But I wouldn't have asked because I wasn't dying to get back on stage. But it was my excuse to see what I felt like doing it today.
Gotcha.
And it did not feel great. But then I get itches where I felt like I did when I went out with Justin for those first couple of months. Where,
right.
Oh, I want to do this again. I think I can do this. But I don't have the same incentive. I don't have the same hunger. I'm certainly not as naive as I used to be, and that's not a good thing. So, I don't know. If I'm not bringing anything new to the table, then I don't see the point. And when I say something, I just mean new material, new... I always told young comics, if they asked, everything has been said. Everything has been talked about. And the goal is just to come up with your spin on all the same shit.
Yeah.
Relationships are never going to go out of style. It's never going to be hacky to talk about relationships. But what's your take on it?
Yeah.
So if I could ever bring my true personality to a stage instead of hiding behind clever jokes and wordplay and shit, maybe. But, you know, I've been drawing since I was a kid, so this is sort of... What I'm doing now is more of rewarding now than getting on stage.
Yeah.
And I know those guys who all they had was comedy and then didn't have it, and...
That's devastating.
Yeah, it's devastating. Because then, you know, I still don't know what I'm going to do years from now.
Yeah.
But... right now, this is making me the happiest I've been in years. It's just because, again, it's everything. It's everything it's music, design, comedy, and...
Does it feel like a rebirth, almost? Yeah. I know that might sound corny, but...
No, I feel like I'm pro-regressing. Because I'm doing everything I did as a kid.
Okay.
But as an adult and for money. I still kind of dress the same. I mean, I had plaid shirts when I was a kid. Jeans. One of my goals since I was old enough to form this thought was I never want to have a job where I can't wear jeans to work.
Oh, I love that.
Eastside Cafe. I worked there for 3 years. Oh, yeah. You can wear jeans. they just went out of business.
I know. I just heard and it's...
That was a special fucking place. I still have 4 or 5 dear friends from back then. Comedy. I started back then.
So they were one of the first, like... Farm to table, kind of like.
Yeah, they had a garden in the back, and that was back when Eastside was shitty. And people made it a point to go to that. You know, it's a great example of a good product.
Right.
And people went over there for that good product, despite the shitty neighborhood.
They arguably turned the neighborhood.
Yeah, and I lived across the street, and so I was early for work every day. Everyone was so fucking cool and nice and funny to work with.
Yeah.
It was great. But,
we were there recently and not long after that is when I heard the announcement. I was like, what? We were just there. It's like when someone passes away. It's like, what? I was just with them.
I know. I was living on Manor before this place. I was in Sandstone.
Uh-huh.
It was supposed to be a 2-month thing while they revamped the place I was living in downtown, but then I was like, this is great. And I used to live there years before,
right?
And so it was nostalgic, but then all the stuff went up, all these bars and coffee shops.
Yeah.
It was uber convenient. So I'm glad I ate more at Eastside that year than I did the past decade.
Oh, that's good.
So I'm glad I got it in, and, but yeah, that was, anyway, I forgot your question.
I think we started mourning the Eastside Cafe. Okay. The shirt project is your passion right now. Yes. Obviously, because it's your whole world comes together.
And I had a year of not that.
Right.
And that's, you know, you're rudderless. I'm out in the middle of the ocean with no gas in my powerboat.
What?
I just felt like I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
What kind of sparked that project?
I hired a PR firm to do work for me.
Uh-huh.
Because I finally figured, let me put some money into my business.
Right.
And because I do so well at parts and labor, that's my bread and butter right now.
Yeah.
I figured, well, I don't do any advertising online, so maybe with some...
Right.
That will translate. Those parts and labor sales will translate... Tenfold. I was happy if I sold 50 shirts a month online. That would have been great.
Right.
And so for 6 months, they just bled me dry. And I was so disappointed of everything they did. Everything. There was freshman level copywriting. All they did was use the photographs that I gave them. They didn't make anything clever. They didn't make Instagram stories. They didn't do anything unusual. It's like the whole point was to gather a new audience for me. And it was like, well, you got lots of engagements today. And like, what the fuck? Engagements? I need sales.
Right.
And so after 6 months, and it was a big lesson when I left social media for a month, I was like, oh, I can't leave one. I was like, wait a minute. For 6 months of constant social media activity, nothing happened.
Right.
No one was paying attention. But it was a lesson because people weren't... They don't buy my shirts at Parts and Labor because they're my shirts.
Right.
And they're cool. They buy them because they come from a cool boutique in Austin. And they're mostly tourists who buy them. So you asked me what birthed this. It was necessity. It was, I need a product that I can pitch.
Right.
Because my current line of t-shirts, they're fine, but there's nothing to grab onto. And honestly, I haven't done a new one in so long. I just got uninspired.
Yeah.
And so, first of all, I made those fake tags that you see. I was trying to compete with El Arroyo. They have their sign, you know, and they have, and so I just made those fake clothing tags and just took my old tweets and other comics tweets because it's like, well, you guys aren't doing anything interesting. And so that idea came about, and then the mock idea, the mock band thing, I was like, this has been in my notebook. Let me put some serious time into this and see if it's worthy of pursuing.
I love it.
And it was just because I just spent $4,000 for nothing. I was so mad. And this is not a time where I could spend money.
Yeah.
But I sat down, I wrote all the names. I wrote 50 band names and 30 made the cut. And then I sat down and wrote tour names that were punny. And then I spent January working on one design per day.
Jeez.
I gave myself, and this is more work than I've done in years and years.
Jeez.
And so I wanted them to have a feel like your friends in a band and said, hey, we need t-shirts by Friday. Can you come up with something? And if you want, after this, I'll show you.
Yes.
A sneak peek. I put them all on my wall when they're done.
I keep glancing around. I'm like, am I seeing anything that gives me a clue?
Oh, no, they're all... And that's something else that was great because normally if I'm on social media and I make a new design, I'm so excited to share it. But then eventually it needs tweaking or changing or deletion.
Right.
And so to put them all on my wall for the past 30 days and not releasing them has been awesome.
Yeah.
Because I'm finding problems. And even the ones that you're going to see, it's like, that one's going to be different because of this, and I changed this. And, yeah, it's just been, this past month has been the best month I've had in, a good 5 or 6 years.
Because you're an artist creating and producing.
And I like what I am creating and producing.
Yeah.
And that is something else about comedy. I was not happy with what I was producing. And I'm a terrible salesman. I can't sell shit that I don't believe in.
Yeah. It goes back to the authenticity.
Sincerity. Everything is sincerity. And the reason I hate myself around people like Rich Miller and Dudley is because I get insincere.
Yeah.
I'm not able to be me. And I can feel it. I could feel like, I actually had a conversation with Rich about this.
Really?
And because I hate not knowing things. I hate not knowing why.
Right.
And so I was like, you know, Rich, I'm getting the sense you give me the cold shoulder or something. He's like, well, I'll tell you, Mario, you kind of rub me the wrong way. And immediately I was like, you know what? I get it. It's like, I understand. And it's because you're in a position to give me something and I get obsequious.
Yeah.
And as proof of that being true, now that I don't need shit from Rich or Colleen or anybody, I'm able to just talk
right. And
be me and be laid back and actually funny and not some kiss ass afraid of stepping on someone's toes and blah, blah, blah. So
you're able to actually connect with them.
Yeah. Yeah. I could talk to Colleen now. I can talk to anybody. But before, I was like, oh, I need something from you. So, it's so stupid. I hate that dynamic.
I get it. So, I'll close with this. I asked you one word to describe your past.
Mm-hmm.
What's one word to describe your future?
Ugh. Is that a word?
Sure, we'll make it a word.
I don't know. I don't, if I think too far ahead, I'm kind of a happy-go-lucky person, which pisses me off when I get depressed, because my depression is usually situational, and work takes me right out of it. And I'm fortunate for that, too. I know people who are chemically depressed, and fuck that.
Yeah.
But if I think too far ahead, I'll freak out, you know? I don't blame any woman for not taking a chance on me. I don't have a safe future. I have no fucking clue what I'm going to do. And even though I should look back on all the evidence of how I'm pretty resourceful, I still don't know. I still feel like all my things are little penny ant stuff.
Yeah. You know? Well, then at the risk of thrusting you into an existential crisis, how about one word to describe your Friday?
Today Friday?
Tomorrow.
All right. Here's the word for the future. Productive.
Awesome.
Because I have to be. Because it makes me happy. And, all these cliches you hear, and this I've known this forever, too. Eventually they sink in.
Yeah.
Eventually one sinks in. I think, I forget who said this, but Epiphany is, he was a comedian too. Or Lily Tomlin, I think Lily Tomlin said this.
I love her.
I could be getting this wrong too. An epiphany is a sudden realization of something you've known all along.
Yeah.
And it's like, you hear a cliche over and over, like your parents say.
It's funny when you said that, I was like, oh, it is.
Yeah, it is, yeah. But you'll hear a cliche that all of a sudden it's like, oh, God, now I get that that stupid fucking cliche that everyone says.
And I've had a few of those.
Well, the whole, like, life is wasted on the young. They don't really get that until, I can't believe I'm 47. I can't believe it. I feel like I'm 27. And maybe that's a problem.
No, I get it. I'm forever, and I feel 23. Yeah. So, but
having no kids does that. I think if I had a family, I would feel 47.
Yeah. Or 77. So, in closing, what can we promote for you?
Mock Band Tees.
Okay. Is that the website,
or well, is it going to be on? Well, the website is One Color. One Color is my the company.
And with a K, correct?
With a K, right. One Color with a C was taken. Simple as that.
Bastards.
But I actually like the way OK
came right.
Because now, because I think all my designs are just one color, and they're just OK. So the new stuff, if you go to mockbandtees.com, it will redirect towards the page where they all sell.
Okay.
And only 5 have been released so far. 4 are available in stores, but all 30 are going to be available by South by Southwest.
Really?
And
okay.
And on the back of every shirt is the same 20 cities.
With the same dates?
There's no dates.
Okay.
But there's just city names listed down the back, and whatever design matches the front. And I Googled the top 20 shittiest cities, or least populated, or just the top worst cities to live in. Like, one of the cities in the back is William Cannon. Willow Canyon, Arizona, population 1.
Oh, bless.
So every city, every shirt has the same 20 cities, and they all end up in Juarez, Mexico, and never to be seen again. And then I write blurbs. That's been a lot of fun. I write, like, 3-sentence blurbs a la a music critic about said fake band.
Oh, I love it.
And, like, I'm excited
about it. So up my alley.
But when all 30 are out, I think that's when people are going to be, like, I'm telling myself to expect nothing until all 30 are done.
Okay.
And I can pitch and, like, point to 30. And all the tour names. There was one band that I was going to chuck because I couldn't come up with a good tour name. The band was Vagabondage.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that's the thing. All these shirts are just slightly funny. They shouldn't be too smack you over the head because
right.
I want you to ask, is that a real band? And that's why I put a year on some of the tour, like, you know, U.S. Tour 79, because I think putting a year makes you think it might be a real band.
If anyone ever forms a band based on one of your shirts, will you love it or will you sue them?
No, that would be flattery. Because that'd be like, if there's a band called Milhouse, where'd they get that from? It's
right.
an homage, you know?
Right.
So Vagabondage, I couldn't think of a tour name. And I just started doing some word association, which all these things are.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, I wrote down all these words for, you know, associated with being a hobo, and words associated with S&M, and I came up with whips and trains. So, look forward to more of that shit.
I love it!
But again, after we hang up here, you're going to see the sneak preview, which no one has seen.
I can't wait.
So there you go, mockbandtees.com, and then maybe I'll go on stage, maybe I won't.
Levitt. Thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Sorry it took so long.
No, I love it. And you can find us, comedywham.com, for more interviews. Go. Also, we are available where you get your podcasts. And please rate and review us, especially on iTunes. That's how people find us. Thanks so much for listening. And Mary, thank you again.
Thank you.